This is Geology Bites with Oliver Strumpel. Scattered around the globe, within both oceanic and continental plates, are some massive accumulations of igneous rocks called large igneous provinces. What causes such huge volumes of magma to flow onto the Earth's surface, and what impact does their emplacement have on the plates where they erupt, the atmosphere and climate, and life? Richard Ernst has been studying all aspects of large igneous provinces for nearly three decades and has written the definitive textbook on the subject. He is scientist in residence at Carleton University in Ottawa. Richard Ernst, welcome to Geology Bites.
Thank you, Oliver. It's great to be here.
There are many places where volcanism has produced a lot of basalt on the surface of the Earth, not least from mid-ocean spreading ridges and volcanic arcs. Is there an accepted definition of a large igneous province that distinguishes them from such other forms of volcanism?
As originally defined in 1990, the basic aspect was a large volume intraplate event, typically with a short duration. And the minimum size was conceived as around 100,000 cubic kilometers. The intraplate setting distinguished from ordinary seafloor spreading and collisional related activities. And they can be very, very short duration, oftentimes less than a million years, or can be multiple pulses over a longer period of time.
But basically, it's a bulk of extruded magma is where the definition lies, right?
That's the main thing. That's how it was originally recognized. It was these huge flood basalts observed in many parts of the world that could be kilometers thick of basaltic lava with very little interflow sediments. And so it was really recognized that these were kind of a unique sort of thing. And then they took this to the oceanic realm and recognized similar kind of thick accumulations of extrusive material.
Can you describe the structure of a large igneous province?
At the surface, you could see the huge flood basalts that might be extensive over many, many hundreds of kilometers, covering up to a million or more square kilometers. But as the flood basalts are eroded, you see more of the plumbing system. You see giant radiating dike swarms that can have a radius of up to 2,000 kilometers or more, giant circular swarms that could have a radius of almost 1,000 kilometers. Also, you have massive sills, dolerite sill provinces associated with sedimentary basins. You also have the important group of mafic, ultramafic intrusive complexes that are also an important part of the plumbing system. And then as you go deeper, you get down to the magmatic underplate that's often present, where you might have up to 10 million cubic kilometers or more of material accreted to the base of the crust as mafic to ultramafic material. So the plumbing system is really quite extensive and indicates that these events are really even more voluminous than we realize from just looking at the extruded flood basalt.
But if I was standing on top of a large igneous province or on a continent of flood basalt, would I recognize it from the plumbing system, or would I just see endless sheets or thick sheets of successive lava flows?
Yeah, that's the way you would recognize it. You'd see yourself sitting on top of, as far as the eye could see, basaltic volcanism, Hawaiian-style volcanism, but on steroids. If you have windows through it where the basalts were eroded, then you might see some of the dike swarm component and the other plumbing system component.
I have been to some of these large igneous provinces, for example, on the western coast of Greenland and then also in the Deccan. And you can, when it's eroded through by a gully or something, just see layer upon layer upon layer upon layer, endless layers of successive lava flows.
Yeah, dramatically so. And even in the ones that have been deeply eroded, like the Mackenzie event of northern Canada, where the dike swarm component goes out to 2,000 kilometers, in the focal region of this overall radiating swarm, you have the remnant of what must have been originally very, very extensive flood basalt sequence, the Coppermine volcanics, a couple kilometers thick or so.
What are the best known large igneous provinces? Where are they? And roughly how many have been recognized?
One of the most dramatic is the Siberian Trap large igneous province, which extends over about 5 million square kilometers in Siberia. Other hugely dramatic ones are the Central Atlantic magmatic province at 201 million years ago. So those are two well-known ones. You mentioned the Deccan as well of India at 66 million years. It is widespread in India. Those are the youngest ones, and there's lots more young ones. But also, as you go back through time and you look at the plumbing system component, we can trace them all the way back into the Archean. And up through the Proterozoic, about 2.5 billion years ago, at the end of the Archean, we have them occurring every 20 or 30 million years somewhere on the planet. And if you add in the oceanic plateaus, which are only visible in the last 200 million years, while we still have current oceanic crust, but we know the oceanic plateau component continues back through time. We can see them as remnants in collisional zones of oceanic plateaus from closed oceans. And so we suspect that the rate of large igneous provinces back through time might be as often as 1 every 15 million years or so, back through about 2.5 billion years ago. And then in the Archean, we're doing a new compilation based on all the new geochronology, et cetera, and it's looking like the rate is going to be fairly similar.
So you're saying really all the way back to the Archean, we're talking about one of these being in place roughly every 15 million years?
Potentially as often as that, and certainly every 20 to 30 million years based on the continental large igneous province record. But to my mind, we talk about plate tectonics a lot, and it's a dominant mechanism on Earth. But this whole other process, this whole other voluminous magma production feature of Earth is also incredibly important.
Could you talk about the geochemical makeup? So being basaltic, we're talking fundamentally about mafic composition, but there's also, as I understand it, a variation between ultramafic at the one end and also some fairly silicic components of these large igneous provinces.
That is certainly true for the continental examples, where it's mainly mafic with some ultramafic component, but you can also have some more granitic compositions as magma crystallizes, the residual liquid becomes more granitic through a fractionation of the magma. You can generate from the mafic magma some amounts of granitic type magma. But the other thing that is a really fascinating component of continental large igneous provinces is the potential for the thermal source causing massive partial melting of the lower mafic crust. And if you melt a basaltic lower crust, you produce a granitic melt. And so you can get massive provinces of granitic melt associated with large igneous provinces from the same heat source. But these massive provinces are interesting because they can have remarkable scale, 100,000 square kilometers or more. It's well known that you produce a lot of granitic-type magmatism in collisional environments associated with subduction. And as you go back in time, it can be hard to tell what setting you're in. And so when you have a large granitic magmatic province of some age, is it evidence of a plate tectonics collisional zone, or is it an example of a large igneous province producing silicic magmatism?
Can you give an example of one of those?
The Karoo Large Igneous Province, which is a massive event across southern Africa into Antarctica. And there's a felsic equivalent of it in southern South America, the Chonaiki event.
How long does it take to form a particular large igneous province? Or to put it another way, do they have a typical magma extrusion rate?
The geochronology on the Siberian Trap event indicate that this 5 million cubic kilometer or more event, not including any underplate component, which would probably make it much larger, all came out within less than a million years. The Central Atlantic Magmatic Province, which covers some 10 million square kilometers, uranium lead dating suggests that most of it must have come out again within a million years or so, an incredibly short period.
Where exactly is the Central Atlantic Magmatic Province today?
The center of activity, from the North American perspective in Florida, from the African perspective, it would be the corner of Africa. If you close the Atlantic Ocean, you tuck it in adjacent to Florida there, and that's the center. But you have magmatism along the entire coast all the way up to Newfoundland on the Canadian side. It's also extensive down into Brazil, into the Amazon Basin, and then into West Africa, all the way up into Mauritania, Mali, up into Morocco, Algeria, up into Iberian Peninsula as well. So it's a massive event, and everywhere we see it and date it, it seems to have a 201 plus or minus one or so million year age. However, there are also events that are coming out in multiple pulses that might span tens of millions of years. One of the ones that's important is the North Atlantic Large Igneous Province, which is on Greenland, the units in Greenland you were talking about, and also in the UK and offshore as well. That North Atlantic Igneous Province has a main pulse at 62 to 58 million, and then a second pulse with the onset of rifting in the North Atlantic at 55. And Iceland, right in the middle of the North Atlantic, which is active today, represents the continuation of the North Atlantic Large Igneous Province at a much lower volume and flux rate. What happens many times is you have these large igneous provinces with a huge volume of magma in a short period of time, and then there's protracted magmatism at a much lower pace for another 100 to 200 million years. So Iceland has pulses at 60 million years, then a second pulse at 55. Other events also have multiple pulses, oftentimes with the second pulse associated with the onset of rifting and continental breakup.
Are they unique to our planet?
They are not unique to our planet. On Venus, we see just a wealth of what we think of as large igneous provinces. On Venus, there's no plate tectonics, and so one of the things that's come from the study of huge flood basalt events, lava flows continuing for 1,000 kilometers or more. We've also recently discovered huge dike swarms on Venus. Venus has no erosion, no plate tectonics. Erosion is important because we see the surface expression of lava flows. We also see the surface expression of dikes laterally. We think of dikes moving up. They do, but they also can move sideways in the crust for long, long distances. We know that from Earth. We see that demonstrated vividly on Venus, and we can trace them for long distances as swarms of dikes radiating for thousands of kilometers. We just recently traced a single one for almost 4,000 kilometers. And because of the absence of plate tectonics, it really lends support to a mantle plume model. Let me also mention Mars. Mars has graben systems interpreted to be dike swarms 3,000 or 4,000 kilometers long, associated with and radiating from this area of protracted plume-related volcanism called the Tharsis region, and also on another region antipodally called the Elysium region. So there's boundless radiating graben systems on Mars that are also interpreted to represent huge laterally in place mafic dike swarms associated with what we would call large igneous provinces on Earth.
Let's talk about what might generate these prodigious volumes of lava that form these large igneous provinces then. I understand that there are two categories of model, each of them providing a mechanism that generates anomalously hot mantle material at shallow levels. The first involves shallow, by which we mean crustal and upper mantle processes, and the second invokes the deep mantle with the arrival of a hot mantle plume. Let's start with the former explanations.
So there are a number of shallow mechanisms. The lithospheric portion of the surface plate can drop off and descend into the mantle as a process called delamination. And if so, then hotter material from the mantle below can rise to a shallower level and produce large volumes of melt. It's also been well recognized that rifting, extension, as you thin the plate, then you also bring hotter mantle material to a shallower level, and it can then also cause partial melting. There's another class of shallow models that also sort of things to a supercontinent cycle. We know that the continents come together and break apart and come together, and that's happened several times in Earth history, the most recent time being Pangaea, that was together over the last few hundred million years and started to break apart around 200 million years ago. When you assemble all these continents together, there's a region of mantle that is covered by thicker crust, granitic crust, and it represents some sort of thermal blanket, so the temperature can then build up in the mantle underneath, then potentially enough to generate melting.
I'm reminded of the episode of Geology Bites that we did with Peter Molnar, where he talked about the foundering of an anchor below Tibet as an explanation of why it's so high today, and I think that is what you're referring to by delamination of the lithosphere and a heavier portion below sinking into the cenospheric mantle below. And Similarly, Damien Nance also talked about the thermal blanketing just in the last episode of ways in which you could get extra heating that would then lead to the demise of a supercontinent.
So let's talk about the second category of model, namely the ones that involve the deep mantle and the mantle plume.
You have a plume that rises, and the top of the plume is growing as it rises because it is being filled from below faster than it can push its way up through the mantle. And so the size of the plume head is predictable by the modeling, and you get a plume head at the top that's many hundreds of kilometers across and flattens when it reaches the base of the plate to something potentially 2,000 kilometers across. And this kind of arrival and flattening can take place within a very short time, meaning that you suddenly get into a zone where massive melting happens very, very quickly, leading to large igneous provinces and providing an explanation for very rapid generation of huge volumes of melt. So this mantle plume idea has also been useful for us with respect to radiating dike swarms. We see in the Mackenzie swarm, which is one of the most magnificent in the world, it extends out over 2,000 kilometers in radius.
Where is that located?
In northern Canada. So it continues from northern Canada, the Arctic coast, all the way down, not too far from Lake Superior. The radiating swarm is the kind of thing you get from domal uplift above a mantle plume. A plume lifts up the crust a kilometer or so and produces radial fractures that are filled by magma from the plume, and you get a radial swarm. The swarm in the Mackenzie and the swarm of many others is radial for a distance and then swings beyond a certain distance, influenced by some sort of regional stress external to the plume. And we take that transition as a measure of the size of the underlying plumes. So in the case of the Mackenzie, it transitioned from radiating to swinging into another regional stress pattern beyond at about 1,000 kilometers, consistent with this mantle plume modeling.
Do these various models also help explain what we see on Mars and Venus then?
Indeed, they do. On Venus, I mentioned this nearly 4,000 kilometer long individual dike. It radiates away from a big volcanic center, radiates out 1,200 kilometers and then swings about 50 degrees into a trend that's parallel to a rift zone that's 10,000 kilometers long. So we have a dramatic change in trend right at 1,200 kilometers, consistent with hundreds of other dikes that we see as part of the radiating system. But this particular individual dike shows it so dramatically. On Mars, we see beautiful radiating swarms that seem to go out 3,000 or 4,000 kilometers. And the entire Tharsis rise is larger than 5,000 kilometers across, so it's a big event on its own.
How does the model explain the initial radial pattern and then at a certain radius, the swinging of the dikes?
In order to drive a dike out laterally for that far, you have to have a lot of magma. So you have to have magma continually being pumped into the starting end of the dike. The source area for dike magmas is typically near the plume center. So within a few hundred kilometers of the plume center, we can see in some cases gravity anomalies marking intrusions from which the dikes were pumped out. And they're pumped out initially in the direction given by the domal uplift, which imposes stress on the crust that favors radiating openings. And so the magma that's being pumped outward from the center region takes advantage of these preferred opening directions and happily drives out laterally and keeps driving out sideways. And then if it gets beyond the plume head, there is still regional stress. On Earth, it's related to plate boundary stresses. In continental areas away from spreading zones or collisional zones, there's intraplate stresses that have preferred directions. And so the idea is that the magma keeps being pumped into the starting end of the dike, and the magma keeps moving at the far end. And once it gets beyond the domal uplift, beyond the influence of the stresses related to the uplifting plume head, the magma still wants to go, and it's going to happily go in the direction of whatever the stress it experiences at that point. And on Earth, it's presumably related to some sort of plate boundary or collisional subduction stresses. On Venus, we see this one that parallels this huge rift zone for 2,000 kilometers of its 10,000 kilometer long full length of that rift zone.
As we look through the geological record, we often see a temporal coincidence between the emplacement of a large igneous province and continental rifting. Can you give some examples of this, and do we understand why this is so?
We clearly see many examples where a rival of a large igneous province is associated with attempted breakup and often successful breakup to open a new ocean. On one hand, you have the Central Atlantic Magmatic Province at 201 million years, which precedes the opening of the Atlantic by 5, 10, 15 million years. Beautiful correlation there. On the other hand, you have the magnificent Siberian Traps, Large Igneous Province, which did try to break up Siberia from Europe. The west of Siberia has major rift zones that are part of the Siberian Trap event and represent serious attempted breakup, but ultimately unsuccessful. So this points out that there's two aspects that are relevant. You have to have favorable plate boundary stresses in order for there to be successful. In the case of the Central Atlantic, there was already a whole series of rift basins, at least on the North American side, called the Newark series of basins, that represented north-south rifting prior to the ultimate breakup that happened 30 or 40 million years later after the arrival of the Central Magmatic Province. So in that case, you'd say there was favorable plate boundary stresses that were already interested in causing a breakup. And then the mantle plume arrives, causes some uplift, causes a radiating dike zone, but also causes potential triple junction rifting in multiple directions going north to separate North America from Europe and Africa, and to the south to move South America away.
Ore deposits are linked to large igneous provinces. What kind of ores are these, and do we understand what the connection is?
Yes, we have some good ideas. Most ores for copper, nickel, and platinum group elements, platinum and palladium in particular, they are genetically associated with large igneous provinces. And part of the story has to be with the kind of magma. You get both mafic and ultramafic magmatisms in large igneous provinces. Ultramafic magmatism can often be associated with elevated levels of some of these elements that then can get concentrated in a layered intrusion, for instance, like the Bushveld intrusion in southern Africa, a huge reservoir of many rich ore deposits. It's a single body that extends 400 kilometers across and maybe 7 kilometers thick, a huge body of magma that differentiates and produces significant ore deposits at different levels. And it's part of a large igneous province at a little over 2 billion years ago in southern Africa. The Norilsk magmatic sulfide deposits in the Siberian Trap event, those seem to have interacted with silica-rich units at some point, causing sulfur saturation and production of a separate magmatic sulfide liquid that can interact with the huge volumes of magma that might be moving by it in a magma chamber. The idea is, if you have a separate liquid adjacent to the basaltic liquid, as the basaltic liquid is moving by it, its sulfur-loving elements like nickel and copper and platinum group elements jump out of the basaltic magma and jump into the sulfide magma and progressively get more and more rich in the magmatic sulfide. And that's part of the reason then that large igneous provinces are important in magmatic sulfides, because they have a potential for huge volumes of magma to move by magmatic sulfides and continually offer them the opportunity to get more and more enriched in the sulfur-loving elements, nickel, copper, and PGEs that are very important in the Green Revolution.
We also see a correlation between the emplacement of a large igneous province and a major mass extinction. Can you give examples of these, and how do we think this comes about?
Yeah, the best perhaps is the Siberian Trap event that I mentioned before, which covers northern Siberia and central Siberia. All of it seems to be in place within less than a million years, and precisely within a short time, both preceding and post-dating the well-dated timing of the Permo-Triassic mass extinction. So that's a superb example. I mentioned the Central Atlantic Magmatic Province, 201 million years. It precisely brackets the Triassic-Jurassic mass extinction. The Deccan event, large igneous province in India, again, most of it is less than a million years. It does seem to have two or three distinct pulses, very short duration for the main pulse. Again, bracketing in time the mass extinction associated with the demise of the dinosaurs. In that particular case, the dating on the Chicxulub meteorite impact in the Yucatan Peninsula seems to give a similar age. And so it looks like it's a joint effort between a large igneous province and a meteorite impact in that case in causing that extinction.
I presume the extinctions are thought to be a consequence of the global environmental impacts of these enormous eruptions that create these large igneous provinces. But what exactly is so inimical to life?
There's a bounty of riches in that regard. There's rapid global warming, 15, 20 degree temperature increases above present. And acid rain can be an important component. The Siberian Traps event modeling shows that there's CO2 and SO2 sulfur dioxide coming out, but there's also the thermogenetic gases. So this huge amount of gas release from sills, the intrusive component, interacting with sediments. And in the case of Siberian Trap, there's the opportunity to interact with hydrocarbons, with oil deposits. Also an opportunity to interact with evaporite, sedimentary deposits you get in deserts from evaporation of water. They heated up some evaporite sort of sediments to see what would be released from sill at 1,000 degrees being adjacent to such sediments. And they would release chlorine and bromine compounds. So those are ozone destroying. So the ozone destroying is also a possibility. Mercury release as well. Poisonous mercury. It seems that mercury levels are higher from large igneous province events. So they are a source of mercury poisoning potentially. Paradoxically, you can also have remarkable cooling episodes that are associated with large igneous provinces. If you erupt a large igneous province at the equator, there's a lot of flood basalts, and then they can be rapidly eroded within a million years or so, and that sucks a lot of CO2 of the atmosphere. So if you're in a cooler transition time, it's enough to potentially pull you into a snowball Earth where the oceans are frozen to the equator. And an example of that is the longest snowball Earth in this Earth's history from about 719 million to 660 million years ago, so-called Sturtian glaciation. And what occurred right at the absolute beginning of that? There's a huge large igneous province in Canada known as the Franklin Large Igneous Province, 2 or 3 million square kilometers in Canada, whose precise age is 719, like a million years before the onset of the Sturtian glaciation. And yet there's more. We have the same age event in formerly attached Siberia called the Irkutsk Large Igneous Province. And there's more. We have at the same time in the portion of southern Africa and probably into adjacent Antarctica, another large igneous province called the Mutari Fingerin that's of the same age. And also in South China, there's a large igneous province of the same age. And probably in northern Europe, in Baltica, there's another large igneous province of the same age. Some of these other ones are also at the equator, so the causing of the Grand Sturtian Glaciation Snowball Earth event due to a large igneous province, almost certainly the Franklin Large Igneous Province was the cause, and in a time where it was already cooling down.
It's interesting that for some of these, you eject a ton of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and you jack up the temperature by 10, 20 degrees. Yet for others, it's the subsequent effect of the drawdown of CO2 from all the erosion leading to cooling that is the major effect. I suppose it's a question of different timescales.
It seems a little more complicated than that because you also have sulfur dioxide released. And so that's initially greenhouse warming, but it can also convert to a sulfate very rapidly and become solar blocking. So you have the CO2 pulse initially from the gas, both from the volcanics and from the heating up by sills of adjacent sediments. The sulfur dioxide component, if it's large, takes you from an initial warming and starts some cooling. And then if you rapidly remove and erode the basalts at an equator, you more than compensate for whatever CO2 you put into the atmosphere and you have a net loss. So you would expect a little bit of a pulse of warming right at the beginning, to sulfite aerosol, slight transition then to some cooling, and then if the erosions kicks in, then it can be even more dramatic cooling.
If 3 or 4 coincident large igneous provinces triggered the Sturtian glaciation in the Neoproterozoic, what about the Marinoan snowball episode that came soon after the end of the Sturtian?
There are some candidates both for the interruption between the Sturtian and the Marinoan, that you have pump a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere, and that may have temporarily taken us out of the Sturtian, and then there's another candidate at the end of the Marinoan for potentially ending that period. And then there's also the Gaskier's glaciation at 580 or so, which seems to have been very short, and it may have been both started and ended by a large igneous province, started by a basaltic large igneous component and ended by the felsic component. Can I mention one other thing? Is we have this wild idea that Venus had a massive climate change from earlier habitable conditions to its modern climate with no plate tectonics and no erosion. Could multiple large igneous provinces happening at the same time on Venus, each of them increasing the global temperature by 10 or 15 degrees, say had three superimposed, you can increase the global temperature by 45 degrees, and that would lead to runaway ocean evaporation and lead to the end of plate tectonics. Water is considered important for subduction to continue. So we propose that this great climate transition from Earth-like conditions on Venus to the current 450 degrees Celsius self-cleaning oven type temperatures was initiated through multiple large igneous provinces happening at the same time. And we have cheekily said, perhaps this is in Earth's distant future. There's nothing to stop a similar mechanism from happening hundreds of millions of years from now.
Richard Ernst, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Oliver.
To see pictures and illustrations that support this podcast, go to geologybytes.com, where you'll also find transcripts and a subject matter index of all the episodes. There you can also give me feedback, which I welcome, as well as sign up to get my emails about new episodes.